Okay, let's unpack this deep dive. We're looking today at, well, one of the most chilling paradoxes in recent American history, really. Our mission here is very specific. We're not going to just recount the awful things John Wayne Gacy did. That's not the goal. Instead, think of this as an ethical excavation. We need to analyze the catastrophic structural failure, how community trust itself was weaponized. How did that facade hold up for so long?
That's exactly right. That's the lesson we have to pull from the records, from the files. For anyone trying to grasp structural vulnerability, this case is just crucial. It's a study in deception. We're exploring how that very bedrock of suburban life, you know, trusting your neighbors, how that can be twisted, exploited for, well, catastrophic harm. And our challenge really is to stick to the documented facts. Focus on the social mechanisms he used and try to separate that from all the rumors that inevitably swirl around cases like this.
Right. So let's set the scene. We're talking early 1970s Chicago suburbs, specifically Norwood Park Township, around his home. This was supposed to be the American dream landscape, wasn't it? Where being involved, being neighborly, that meant you were a good person. The environment itself almost gave him cover, a kind of shield.
He was the picture of it, wasn't he? The successful citizen, on the outside at least, ran his own construction company, PM Contractors, very involved locally. He didn't just seem functional, he seemed, you know, reliable, a pillar of the community. And that's the core of this whole deep dive, isn't it? That brutal contrast, the man with the ultimate painted smile. But underneath that smile, a crawl space that eventually told the absolute truth.
Okay, section one then, the anatomy of a false front. To really get why it failed, we first need to detail just how much he engaged with the community. That was his primary defense. He wasn't just some quiet guy next door. He was hyper visible, almost like performing aggressive friendliness.
Performing is the right word. It wasn't just passive involvement. It was a very deliberate performance of reliability. The records show he actively hosted these huge neighborhood parties, block parties, constantly bringing dozens of people onto his property. He got involved in local politics, joined the Moose Lodge, just constant integration. And the sheer frequency, the scale of it all, it built this massive blind spot in the community. You see someone doing all that, your brain just files them away as safe. Reliable.
And his business, PM Contractors, that wasn't just how he made a living. It was a tool, right? A mechanism for interaction and, terrifyingly, for access. Can you elaborate on that professional angle?
Oh, absolutely. It's crucial. The construction trade gave him perfectly legitimate reasons to interact with young men, often guys looking for quick cash, maybe a bit transient, job interviews, offers of work, needing help on a project. All totally plausible stories. And the documentation often shows, heartbreakingly, that victims were last seen doing just that, accepting a legitimate work offer from Gacy. So the business became this apparatus, constantly bringing vulnerable people right to him, all under the guise of a normal economic exchange.
But the image that just completely shatters any sense of normalcy, the one that feels almost like dark fiction, was his role as Pogo the Clown.
Yeah.
And he didn't just, you know, dress up once. He made it official. He was Pogo.
The Pogo persona. It's arguably the most brilliant and, frankly, devastating part of his deception. Think about what a clown represents socially. Harmlessness, right? Non-threatening fun, specifically linked to making kids happy. He performed at birthday parties, fundraisers, and critically, he performed at children's hospitals. That built this implicit trust. Families, schools, even hospitals trusted him. He gained this social capital that was just almost immune to suspicion.
It feels like calculated psychological warfare. You're not just fooling one person, you're fooling the whole system of trust.
We analyze this as control hiding in plain sight. You know, the analogy we sometimes use, like Disney World, control hides best in plain sight. Gacy didn't need some dark, isolated mansion. His sheer joyful visibility, his charity work, that was his immunity. The community was basically trained structurally to see him as an asset, which made the alternative, the truth, psychologically impossible to grasp.
That's a really profound point about the ethical weight here. It wasn't just lying. It was actively fabricating a whole public life just to deflect suspicion.
And the files, the early reports, testimony,
Yeah.
they all confirm how well it worked. You see it again and again. Everyone trusted him. That trust wasn't just a side note. It was the foundation, the concrete he built his crimes on. It made anyone who did feel suspicious seem, well, not just wrong, but maybe aggressive. Paranoid, even.
Yeah, if he's hosting the block party, visiting sick kids as a clown, running a local business, he becomes socially untouchable. How do you even start to question someone with that much perceived goodwill?
We often look at this through the lens of false fronts, like in the Aladdin story. You know, the public identity wasn't real, it was bait. It was designed to lure people into accepting him without question, to make them ignore their gut feelings or ignore the patterns that were starting to emerge. The more positive things he did outwardly, the more smiles he painted, literally and figuratively, the harder it became for anyone to believe the horror hidden inside his home.
So that deep structural trust, it needed an equally deep structural kind of proof to finally break it.
Exactly. It required something undeniable.
Okay, let's move into section two, the evolving pattern of loss. Because despite this impenetrable social shield, the truth started pushing through. Just by the sheer weight of absence, we're in the early to mid-70s now. Young men, boys, they start vanishing with disturbing regularity in and around the Chicago area. And it wasn't random, it was concentrated, frighteningly close to Gacy's home and work.
The pattern is chilling precisely because of that proximity.
Mm-hmm.
The investigative records are clear. Most of these young men were last seen near his house or near his business or known to have interacted with him recently. His community connections, the construction company, his home, they were the constant epicenter of the danger.
And we have to picture the anxiety building in the community, not instant panic maybe, but this creeping dread. Something's wrong. We see it visually, don't we? And those heartbreaking missing person flyers that started appearing everywhere.
Oh, those flyers. They represent that collective fear mounting piece by piece. Each flyer was a single family's agony, but together they painted a picture, an undeniable pattern that just didn't have an easy answer. Honestly, that many missing people in such a tight area should have set off much bigger alarms much sooner.
So what do the records show about Gacy himself when the police did start asking questions? Because they did question him, right? Acting on tips or just the sheer number of disappearances.
Yes, they did question him. Multiple times, actually. But initially, they treated him like any other potential witness or maybe just a concerned neighbor, and the documents really highlight how effective his confidence was. Whenever police asked him about someone who was missing, he'd just laugh it off. That's the phrase used. He'd claim he knew nothing, maybe express some generic concern, but always casual, utterly relaxed. And that worked initially because everyone, police included, was still under the spell of his reputation. His calm demeanor just reinforced the belief that he couldn't possibly be involved.
Which brings us right to the ethics of it all. Ignoring these warning signs as they piled up, if the disappearances were clustered near him, if he was questioned repeatedly, why did it take so long for the community, for the authorities, to connect those dots into one coherent, terrifying picture?
That is the absolute core question, isn't it? It speaks directly to how communities miss patterns.
Mm-hmm.
It's just incredibly hard for us, for anyone, to maintain critical thinking when you're facing someone so charismatic, so outwardly functional. The cognitive dissonance is immense. It's fundamentally easier psychologically for a neighborhood built on trust to believe the guy who throws the parties, who coaches the kids, than to accept the almost unbelievable truth that he's a monster.
So the sheer social weight of his persona acted like a psychological shield. It made suspecting him feel wrong. Were there records, though, of people who did have doubts early on, maybe family members of the missing or people who noticed something odd? What happened to their concerns?
Oh, absolutely. The files do show there were individuals. Often, yes, family members desperate for answers or maybe casual acquaintances who saw small inconsistencies, people who felt something wasn't right. But their concerns were easily brushed aside by the wider community and initially by the official channels, too. Why? Because Gacy had too many character witnesses, too many public appearances, too many connections. Without hard physical proof, their suspicions just got framed as, you know, grief-stricken, emotional, maybe irrational. Especially compared to his overwhelming social proof.
That tension, then, between the documented record, the flyers, the proximity, and the rumor, or maybe just the gut feeling, it becomes critical. At what point should suspicion, especially cumulative suspicion, outweigh the need for that absolute single smoking gun, particularly when you realize that evidence might be actively hidden because of that social trust?
Well, the system is built to protect the innocent, right?
Yeah.
And Gacy exploited that perfectly. To really go after the beloved Pogo the Clown legally, you needed a level of certainty that was very high. Few were willing to risk their credibility based on patterns or whispers. The social expectation was, and often still is, that evil looks evil or acts isolated. Gacy just defied that completely.
But he kept killing. And that persistence, that awful continuation, forced the issue. The community, the police, they couldn't ignore the growing stack of missing person reports forever. That sheer volume became its own kind of evidence. It eroded the secrecy. It forced investigators finally to look much deeper. Beneath the surface of the perfect neighbor, they couldn't afford not to anymore.
The facade was starting to crack under the weight of the truth.
Okay, section three, the breakthrough and the unpacking. Things take a sharp, irreversible turn in late 1978. The key event was the disappearance of Robert Peast, a 15-year-old, last seen talking to Gacy about a potential construction job. That was the thread that finally unraveled everything, and it led directly to the critical legal moment we can pinpoint in the record, the authorization of a search warrant.
Yes, the December 1978 warrant. That's the official point where the law formally pivoted. From treating Gacy as maybe a witness to treating him as the prime suspect. The Peast family's persistence was incredible, and investigators finally had enough tangible links, enough inconsistencies in Gacy's story that they could secure that warrant. Continued trust was no longer an option.
But even then, the house itself put up one last defense, didn't it? The initial search, when officers first went in, what did they find?
According to the records, it looked completely ordinary. A typical suburban ranch house. Neat, tidy, domestic. It just reinforced that idea of a stable, normal life. It visually contradicted the idea of deviance or chaos. So it wasn't obvious, it wasn't externalized, it was hidden behind this comfortable, totally average facade. The visual evidence still screamed innocent.
Until the physical reality just overpowered that visual lie, the search led them to the definitive moment. The crawl space under the floorboards, and the sources, they really emphasize the sensory detail here, don't they?
They do. That moment is documented as the instant the whole illusion just shattered. When investigators managed to get into that crawl space, the reports consistently mentioned the overwhelming, inescapable smell that hit them. The smell of decomposition. That was it. That was the physical, undeniable reality Gacy couldn't talk his way out of, couldn't laugh off. That smell was the truth. The house itself confessed, in a way.
And what happened immediately after that? The digging.
Yes.
That's where the scale of this horror becomes truly apparent.
They started digging almost right away, confirming the source of the smell. And the location itself is just profoundly disturbing when you analyze it. The bodies weren't hidden miles away. They were buried right there in shallow graves beneath his own house. He turned the ultimate symbol of safety and sanctuary, his home, into a mass grave. It's an unbelievable violation, turning the very concept of home toxic for that whole community.
It speaks to such a chilling level of control, doesn't it? Living literally above the evidence of his crimes, walking on those floorboards every day, hosting those parties just feet away.
Exactly. The proximity was part of the power dynamic. And then the sheer scale of what they found. It wasn't just one or two victims. The records confirmed that eventually, investigators uncovered the remains of dozens. Dozens of boys and young men buried in that crawl space and elsewhere on his property. This wasn't a momentary lapse. This was a sustained campaign of murder, hidden entirely by that carefully built wall of trust.
We often talk about erasure in these cases. The perpetrator trying to make their victims vanish without a trace. Gacy certainly tried, burying them in that dark, damp, hidden space.
But the ground remembers. That's the analogy we keep coming back to, isn't it?
Yeah.
He tried to erase the records, silence the truth. But the earth itself, the physical reality of those graves, became the ultimate witness. Undeniable. The very foundation of his life, his home, became the irrefutable crime scene that finally tore down his entire persona. The physical environment gave lie to the social one.
Moving into section four, the shockwaves and the record. When this news finally broke, late 78, early 79, the public reaction must have been immense. The collapse of that image, the friendly neighbor, Pogo the clown, into the reality of a mass murderer burying victims under his house. That core contrast suddenly became brutally clear.
Oh, the horror was palpable. It wasn't just local shock. It reverberated across the country. It was a cultural moment. It forced people everywhere to confront this really uncomfortable idea that the person you trust most in your community, the person you invite into your home, the person playing with your kids, could be hiding something utterly monstrous. It fundamentally shook the idea of neighborly trust, exposing how fragile it could actually be.
And the final victim count, confirmed in the official record, just underscores the years of loss that community endured. At least 33 victims ultimately attributed to Gacy. The process that followed, identifying the remains, trying to give families some measure of closure, that was a long, heartbreaking process itself.
It was. And legally, the path forward was pretty clear once the physical evidence from the crawl space came to light. It was irrefutable. That led directly to his trial, his conviction, and the final legal judgment.
And that final historical beat, the one that brought formal closure, even if not emotional closure, came quite a few years later. The record confirms the 1994 execution. That closed the legal chapter. But the questions, the societal lessons about our own vulnerabilities, those definitely remain.
So let's connect the dots. What does this period, this case, teach us about societal vulnerability looking back?
Well, the primary lesson has to be that public trust isn't automatic just because someone is involved in the community. It can be manufactured, it can be leveraged.
And we saw how ingrained that dynamic was, right? That suburban ideal,
yeah.
Trust the guy next door because he's there, he seems okay, he throws good parties. It's almost a structural expectation.
It's like behavioral training. It reminds me of that Monopoly analogy. The game trains you before it pays you. The social structure of the suburbs kind of trained people to automatically trust the visible, friendly neighbor. And that led to this deep, collective, willful blindness about the horrifying pattern unfolding right under their noses. The very expectation of safety created the opening for danger. So the Gacy narrative really confirms that knowledge, true understanding, is most valuable when it fuels critical thinking, when it pushes us to question those surface assumptions. Even about people who seem the most innocent, the most involved in our communities, we have to be willing to look closer to investigate what might be hidden.
Absolutely. We have to get past the easy answer, past just believing the painted smile. We need to recognize that visible goodwill, community involvement, it doesn't automatically guarantee the absence of profound calculated harm beneath the surface.
Okay, let's wrap up this deep dive. We've journeyed today from that carefully crafted painted smile all the way down to the undeniable physical horror found in the crawl space beneath Gacy's home. It's a story that remains so chilling because it was defined by this terrifying secret hidden right there next door to everyone.
And the critical takeaway for us, I think, is moving beyond the myth. Not seeing Gacy as some distant, mythical, evil mastermind, but understanding him through the record. Seeing the persistent local pattern and the very real structural weaknesses in community trust that he exploited. He needed consistency and visibility, not necessarily genius. He needed people to want to trust the surface.
So we'll leave you with this final image, a metaphor really for this entire story and perhaps for other hidden harms as well.
The reminder is stark and it stays with you. A painted smile can hide a grave, but the ground remembers. We ask you to hold on to that image. The dark, damp, confined space beneath a seemingly ordinary home, the crawl space. It serves as this perfect chilling metaphor for all the hidden harms a society might choose not to see because we prefer to believe that safety is only measured by what's bright and welcoming on the surface. True safety, perhaps, demands that we sometimes have the courage to look beneath the floorboards, to scrutinize the darkness.